Baruch Hashem, I must tell you, over the last couple of years, I know that we have lucked out with the ways of this people that we have come into contact with and learned from them.
Many different things that families like ours need to have to be able to function in this world. Rabbi Cohen is one of them. He is a noted author, as you notice in the front of both sides of the mechitza. His book is here. He's available today for a reduced rate of $20 per book. He is a clinician. He is a rov in a shul, and he is a parent. He has a lot. He travels quite often to talk to crowds like this, and he is a noted lecturer. And he's in big demand. We try. First weekend retreat a couple years ago, but he was already booked that weekend and was not able to make it. Baruch Hashem, we this weekend were able to get him. It's my pleasure to introduce Reb David Cohen, Rabbi Cohen.
I want to thank Yedei Chesed, excuse me, for welcoming me here this morning. It's as was mentioned, I feel very much a part of the weekend. I wasn't here for the weekend, but my topic this morning is talking about our marriages, strengthening our marriages in difficult or challenging situations or in a challenging milieu. And my book was mentioned. I have a section in my book on Shalom Bayis, on marital harmony, and I also have a section in my book on raising a child with special needs. And the reason why I have those two chapters in my book is because the Rebbeinu Shalom blessed me with my own child with special needs. I have a 10-year-old son who has Down syndrome, and I also have a lot of experience in working with marriages. So this morning's topic was really a confluence of two areas that I have familiarity with, although I'm not going to be speaking so much about raising a child with special needs this morning, as much as I'll be talking about our marriages and Shalom Bayis, although the context, of course, is, the backdrop, of course, is, you know, all marriages can be difficult at times, and all marriages are fraught with challenges and risks, but certainly when one adds to the equation the added context of having a child who has exceptional or additional needs, it certainly doesn't make a marriage easier when marriage in and of itself already can, in fact, be challenging. I'd be remiss if I didn't begin my remarks by focusing for a few moments on the Zman, the time period in which we find ourselves in. This past week was Rosh Chodesh Adar Aleph. We're all familiar with the well-known dictum and maxim of Chazal. Mishenichnas Adar, Marbim Besimcha. When the month of Adar approaches and enters, we are meant to elevate our level, heighten our level of joy. Mishenichnas Av, Mimatin Besimcha. When the month of Av comes in, so we lower our amount of joy. So a few ha'aros, a few comments about this dictum, this Maimer Chazal. One is just the well-known statement of Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, of mitzvah gedola lios besimcha tamid, that there's a perpetual mitzvah to be joyous, to be happy. And this Maimer Chazal about Adar and Av also accent and highlight this theme of Yiddishkeit in the sense that the Chazal are saying that we have to be marbe or mamit, which means to me that the baseline is simcha. A Jew always has to try to be joyous, to be happy, to be sameach, bechelko or bechelka, to do what they can to accept what Hashem blesses them with and to be joyous about it. Of course, there are periods of time where we have to try to elevate our simcha, to ramp it up, which is the period of Adar, and this year, because of the Uber year, we have a double opportunity to ramp up the simcha. And of course, when the period of tragedy comes later in the year, in the period of Av, we have to be mamait, we have to lessen our simcha. But the yesod, the baseline is simcha. Person has to be besimcha as best as they can, sometimes more, sometimes less. Now, it's interesting if you reflect upon it, The Chazal are saying, Mishenichdas, when the period enters, one has to begin adjusting or attuning their simcha to the period. Now, I understand Mishenichdas av mematid b'simcha, because after all, Shavasar B'Tammuz already began the period of mourning over the destruction, the Churban of the temple, of the Beis HaMikdash. And therefore it makes sense that Rosh Chodesh Av is already a period of mourning, of lessening simcha, of lessening joy. Mishenichdas Adar marbe b'simcha. What happens at the beginning of Adar? Right? The miracles of Purim don't transpire, aren't commemorated until Yudalid or Tesvav, the middle of the month. So why should it be that Mishenichnas Adar marbim b'simcha? So Hurd explained that the osios, the letters Adar, Aleph, Dalid, Resh, if you bifurcate them, if you split them, so what they allude to is Aleph, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, Hashem is one, the oneness, the being, the ultimate being in this world, the Aleph is Dar. Hashem's presence begins to be felt. It's palpable in this Zman, in this period. And of course, there are no coincidences. The Parsha that we read this Shabbos, as we inaugurated the month of Adar, was Parsha's Truma. Parsha's Truma speaks all about the inauguration of the Mishkan, the Kelim, the vessels that are used in the Mishkan. The Mishkan, of course, we know, is the place where HaKadosh Baruch Hu Shechina is Shore, where Hashem's presence, His divine presence, resides in this world. Meloch HaAretz Kvodo, Hashem's presence is everywhere, but ultimately, He selects the Mishkan to be Dar, to place His presence. And Adar is emblematic of this idea as well, that there's a period on the Jewish calendar as we prepare for those miracles. Now we're already beginning to taste, to feel the simcha that is there. But it's interesting, Chazal could have just said, Mishenichdas Adar marbim b'simcha. They didn't need to parallel it to Mishenichdas Av b'ba'atid b'simcha. What is added by teaching us that? I think there's a very important idea here. It's teaching us the same thing, that just like in Av, we're mourning over the Churban, the destruction of the Mishkan, so in Adar, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence is manifest in the bias, we're all familiar probably with the well-known Chazal of Ish v'Isha, Shechina Shruya Beinehem, that Hashem's presence resides between a husband and a wife. The Ish has the Yud, the Isha has the He in the name, Aleph Yud Shin and Aleph Shin He. The Yud He, the Shem Ka, the Shem Hashem. If there's room for Hashem to reside in the bias, in the home, in that Mishkan Ma'at, so then the Shechina Shruya, then there's Simcha. If Chas V'Shalom, there isn't room for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then it's Eish and Eish, it's fire and fire, as opposed to having that presence of Hashem being manifest and being tasted and having that Hashpa in the bias. So just like in Av, which is a period of Churban, so the reason why Chazal linked the two is because we can understand that the period we're in now is very auspicious for Binyan. It's the parallel. Just like that's Churban, this is Binyan. There is an added semblance of Hashem's Shechina being Shoria, of feeling the Ruach of the Zman, of the Simcha, which are all necessary ingredients to have Shalom Bayis, to really feel Hashem's presence in our lives. And we have to actualize and take advantage and inculcate this concept to understand that Adar, Hashem is Dar, Hashem's presence is really there for the taking. It's similar a little bit to the period of Elul as well, right? That we welcome the Shechina, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is closer during the Aseres Yemei Tshuva. But also in this period now of Adar, there's a similar concept. Also, just one other quick idea. Adar also is Rashi Tevas for Aluf Dal Rash, which means that one has to teach oneself to be a dal, to be a rash, to be poor, to be mocked in, to make oneself small. The way that there can be shalom bayis, and by definition, by extension, have the Shechina Shruya in our homes, in our lives, is to make ourselves small, to make room for each other, to make room for others, and not so much to focus on the I. I'd like My remarks this morning are going to be divided into two parts. The first part of my talk is going to be conceptual, trying to explain some of the underpinnings of marriage in general and some of the tensions that are inherent within every marital relationship, some of the differences between men and women, women and men, that make marriage naturally a challenging ground or space to negotiate. And once we do that, then I'd like to transition into some practical insights and advice how to negotiate and manage our relationships, particularly when we have the added challenge of a child with special needs or whatever other challenge may be apparent that challenges that relationship. And then I hope after that to open the floor to various questions and comments. Now, it's very nice the way I began my remarks by saying, Ish v'isha, shchina shruya b'neihem, that we have opportunities for simcha and joy, and we have to try our best to be happy, and we have to try to allow Hashem to penetrate our world, and that this zman that we're in is a time that's the antithesis of Av. It's a time that is more misugal, that is more roy, that it's more proper for all the things that we yearn for, which is shalom and harmony with our spouse, and also Hashem's presence residing in our lives. It's all fine and good, but it's much easier said than done. There are a few jokes, there are many jokes that people make about marriage. I'm just going to share two of them to kind of set a tone in terms of the differences that exist in our natures between husband and wife. So I once heard the following. There was a wife who was very, very frustrated with her husband. This might have been my wife. Because her husband always had a lot of stuff. And his stuff took up a lot of space. I happen to be an avid golfer. I like to golf. If anybody knows anything about golf, so golf, you have a big bag. There's a lot of golf clubs. And we live in a relatively small apartment in Manhattan. And there isn't that much space. And the closets are at a premium. And I have my golf clubs. My wife has her shoes. You know, everybody has the different things they have. But things take up. She gets two closets, I get one closet. It's a good deal. Everybody's happy. But at the end of the day, there space is at a premium. So one day, and this wasn't me, this husband delivered a big yacht, very big boat on their front lawn. His wife was like, what's that? So he sees that she's very upset that he's acquired this yacht, this additional possession. So he says to her, honey, relax, don't worry. I'm going to give you the kavod. I'm going to give you the honor of naming the boat. That's how strongly I feel for you, and I'm sensitive to your needs. We're partners, so I want you to name the boat. So I'm going to go out, I'm going to do some shopping, get some trinkets, some decorations for the yacht. And when I come back, you'll tell me what you name the boat. So he comes back 2 hours later, and in very big black marker, it's written all across the yacht, it says, for sale. Right? I'll tell you another story, which I hope is a joke, but maybe not a joke. We know that husbands and wives have, or men and women have different, they're all different types of jokes about different approaches to the toothpaste or things in the bathroom or men leaving socks around. You know, you name whatever the stereotype is, there are different stereotypes. That dishes not being washed, we'll talk about that a little bit later. There are all different types of stereotypes about men and women and their expectations and their differences. So there was once a woman who was very overwhelmed and very frustrated with her husband, and she went to visit with a female therapist to comfort her. And she comes into the therapist and she starts to talk. She gets very emotional. She completely breaks down. And the therapist gives her a big hug, and she finally feels like comforted, assuaged, and her husband is watching all this. And the therapist turns to the husband and says, you see, this is all she needed. This is what your wife needed. So the husband replies and says, well, I can bring her here on Monday and Wednesday, but Friday mornings I have a chavrusa. So we understand that we men don't get it all the time, right? They say men are from Mars or women are from Venus, and sometimes they say men are from Minsk and women are from Vilna. They're different formulations. But whatever the approach, I think it's true. It's found in Chazal. What makes it true? Chazal say, "Kasha zivugin shel adam kikriyas yamsuf," that our pairing with our spouse is as difficult as the splitting of the sea. It's a well-known question. For our Kadosh Baruch Hu to split the sea is not difficult. So what exactly are Chazal getting at that putting together a man and woman, a husband and wife, is like the Kriyas Yamsuf? So the Maharal of Prague says something very profound. He says that waters tend to coalesce. If you look at water, water tends to come together. It tends to coalesce, come to a point, to a four. So it's the antithesis of the nature of Mayim to be split. So in that sense, it's against the nature of water to have a kriya, to have a splitting. Similarly, with a zivug, it's more common for each individual to be self-interested and look out for themselves than to have to live with somebody else. There's a lot of depth here. I'm not going to go into it so much, particularly in the sense that Adam HaRishon, maybe this is more apparent for men than women, Adam HaRishon was created first, was brought into the world. The way the world is created sets the shoras, sets the fundamental concept of how the world operates. It has hashlachot, it has further implications. So Adam was placed in the world by himself. Chava was fashioned from Adam. Chava was never alone. Chava only came into the world with Adam. Adam was in the world without Chava. So this also speaks sometimes to the inclination of men at times who have, they ever heard of a concept called a man cave or things like that, where men tend to want to be independent. But it's not so important. The idea is that by nature, we're brought up independently. We're brought up in our families of origin. We're brought up by ourselves. The focus of our lives is on our own development. Our families focus on us. Ultimately, at some point, we say, Al-Kain Yazavish et Aviva et Imova Davak B'Ishto V'Ayula Basar Achad. Right? A person comes to the point where he leaves his husband, he leaves his father and his mother, and he's davak b'ishto. Now, it's also strange. Did any of you leave your parents? I mean, don't tell me. Maybe some people, chas v'sholom, don't have any relationship with their parents, but it's a very strange statement of the Torah, right? You should leave your parents? I mean, it doesn't mean literally leave. It's sort of a beautiful pshat. You should leave the mentality that you have when you're with your parents. Right? When we're with our parents, generally, we're the child and we're receiving. And the entire focus is on what we're going to get, not what we're going to give. So, Al-Kain Yazavish et Aviv et Imo v'davak b'ishto. You have to leave behind that childish mentality that it's all about me, it's all about what I'm going to get. And one has to be davak, one has to have dveikus, one has to connect to their spouse and mature and think about not just what I'm going to get, but primarily what I'm going to give. And if I'm able to give in a healthy way, I'll also be able to receive. It will then boomerang back to me and to my benefit. This inherently is the nature of each and every one of us. We're created alone. We die after 120 years alone. And in between, we have to negotiate and learn how to cultivate a persona that can go from being alone or being taken care of to being able to take care of others, whether it's a child with exceptional needs, or a spouse who sometimes can be like a child, depending on the time or the context or the milieu. Now, I don't know about, I actually recently got myself an iPhone. This was like a big accomplishment, not accomplishment, but it was a big step in my life. I 6 months ago, I began a new job, and that job gave me an iPhone. I kind of felt like I was finally part of the rest of the world, because till then, I didn't have an iPhone. I know there are other phones that are on equal level to the iPhone. I'm not getting paid by any of these companies, unfortunately, to promote their wares. But that being said, I think it's an interesting idea. Why did Steve Jobs, Zichrono Livracha, decide to name this item the iPhone or the iPad? If anybody has familiarity with these methods of technology, anybody ever think about it? Why would it be called the iPhone? What? So, yes, so it's interesting. I mean, Steve Jobs was far from a Rebbe or a Torah personality, or from a Yid for that matter. But it's interesting that they understood the mentality. They were trying to create a device that could enable the individual to access the entire world, right? Bishvili nivra ha'olam. The entire world is my oyster. Okay? So he created a tool that's called the eye. It's all about servicing the eye. Now, I happen to have an interest in politics. And as you may or may not know, I'm sure most of you know, there's a presidential election going on. There's campaigning going on for the role of president. Now, there was something very fascinating during the Iowa caucuses about 2 weeks ago. So there was a conservative rabbi who posited a question to Hillary Clinton on the campaign trail. And there was a lot of media attention after the fact to this question because it apparently made Hillary think, kind of stopped her in her tracks. She was kind of a little bit taken aback by the question. She had to really reflect. And what was the question he asked? He actually asked, he marshaled the famous maxim, which is rooted in Chazal, and Rav Simcha Bonami Peshischa, who was commented on this as well, that a Yid always has to carry in his or her pocket two Mamari Chazal. On the one hand, there's Bishvili Nivra Olam, that the world was created for me, or the world is my oyster. On the other hand, one has to have a piece of paper in their pocket that says, Va'anochi Ofar Va'efer, that I am like dust of the earth. So this conservative rabbi actually asked Hillary Clinton how she juggles or balances these competing tensions, on the one hand of being potentially the ruler of the free world, and on the other hand, or we used to be the rulers of the free world, but close to it, and on the other hand, being fallible and recognizing that we don't always have the answer, and we don't always know what's right or what's wrong, and dealing with this challenge. And she gave a relatively sophisticated, thought-out answer. But we in particular have this similar tension in the sense that we live in the I generation. We live very much focused on, by nature, we're loners, as I laid out already. And now on top of it, we live in a cultural context where the emphasis initially is to focus on ourselves and our own needs before the needs of others. And it's very challenging to balance the reality that the world is our oyster, that we really have a lot that we can add to the world and impact the world, but at the same time recognize that we have to be humble and we have to be small, and it's not just about us, and there are other people that also share the playing field and share the stage with us. I heard a beautiful story. Some of you may be familiar with the former chief rabbi of Great Britain. His name is Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, Lord Jonathan Sacks. He tells a story that when he was in his 20s, he was studying at Cambridge University in England, and he was having, we'll call it, an early life crisis trying to decide if he should be a jurist or a rabbi or a political scientist, trying to decide a career track. And there was a Chabad, there was a shliach on campus there at Cambridge who recommended to him that it may be helpful to send a letter to the Lubavitcher Rebbe at 770 to help him clarify his career ambitions. So he wrote a letter as follows. The letter said, "My name is Jonathan Sacks. I'm a student of philosophy. I'm also a student of rabbinics. I'm also a student of law. I have a wife. I have three children. I live over here. I'm thinking about doing this," so on and so forth. 2-page letter. Seals it up, sends it off to 770, and approximately 2 weeks later, the letter comes back. He's all excited, the response. He opens it up, and he sees that it's the exact same piece of paper that he sent without any response. So he's perplexed. He wonders maybe somehow it was like a return to sender, like it never got sent. But then he looked at it a little bit more carefully, and he noticed that everywhere where he said the letter or the word I on the paper were circled in pen, in red pen. So he noticed that seemingly there were about 20, 25 circled I's on the two sides of the paper. And that's all it said. And he deduced from this that the Lubavitcher Rebbe was telling him that if your attitude is going to be I, what am I going to get by doing A, B, or C, you're not going to fulfill your tachlis or your purpose in life or in this world. If your perspective is, what can I bring to the table? What can I give? What can I impart? What do I have to contribute? That's how ultimately you'll be able to make your mark. And Chief Rabbi Sacks shared in public that this very succinct, brief retort to his letter transformed his perspective and enabled him to launch his career in the world of the rabbinate and ultimately becoming the world influence that he's become in various circles, because he was able to reorient and understand that we have to use the eye. Now, we're going to talk later about the reality that you can't give unless your eye is taken care of. If your eye isn't nourished, it's very difficult to then contribute to one's family and to the broader society. So that's very important as well. It's essential. Once heard from Rav Zev Lef, great Rav in Yerushalayim, he said the word ani, aleph, nun, yud, is a very complex word. Aleph represents, as we said earlier, one, echad. Yud represents the tzibur, 10, the koch of a minyan. And the way to be mishalev, the way to connect the aleph to the yud, the individual to the tzibur, is through the nun. Nun is representative of the nun sharei chochma ubina, the 50 realms or rungs of wisdom, of insight, that it takes a lot of wisdom, a lot of chochma, to be able to bind the individual to the tzibur. He then went on to explain that different people have different size communities where they want to impart their eye onto the tzibur. Gedolei Yisrael, the greatest of the generation, so their eye, encapsulated within their eye, is the entirety of Klal Yisrael. The smaller the person, you know, it's a smaller realm of what, how you define your eye, how much of the yud is inculcated or imbued within your aleph, within your eye. But minimally, we want to aspire to be individuals, particularly if we're married and we have children, we have families, we want to be individuals who embedded within our aleph is our spouse, is our children. Not that we see them apart from us or as separate entities from us, but rather that with the chachma, that hopefully some that we're going to explore now, and with other chachma that's available, to be able to refine ourselves and our character, to be able to appreciate that ultimately all that are within our bias, within our home, within the sphere of our broader family, that they're part of me. It's part of I. When I think about me, I'm not just thinking about me, individual, as a child, the way I grew up in the home of my parents, Al-Kenya Zavishat Avivet Imo, but rather that as I mature and I grow, I recognize that my I is defined in much broader terms, that it's not just about me, it's very much about how it impacts and affects those who surround me, those who live with me, those who are in my domain within my Dalet Amos. And before we get to the practical aspects, I just want to make one other point. And that is, I think all in this room know that life can be challenging, that there are many ups and downs. We know in Parshas Vayetze, Yaakov Avinu has a dream. Yaakov has a dream. There are angels that are going up and down the ladder. And the pasuk concludes, "V'hinei Hashem nitzav alav," and Hashem was standing over Yaakov, watching over Yaakov as this is transpiring, as he falls asleep in dreams on the Mokom HaMikdash on Har HaMoriah. Rav Tzadok HaKohen Milublin says that this is emblematic of the struggle of every Yid, of every Jew. Yaakov Avinu has his name changed to Yisrael. Why is Yaakov called Yisrael? Because Yaakov is really the Bechir HaAvos, he is the Shiftei Ka, he is the one who reflects the challenges that every Jew, particularly the Golish Jew, has to struggle with, is challenged with, that they're ups and downs. And even Malachei Elokim, even the Tzadikim, even the most elevated amongst us, have aliyot and yiridot, have times when they're going up and they're going down. And we always have to remember, v'hinei Hashem nitzav alav, says Rav Tzadok, that Hashem stands by us to support us, that we have Him to rely on, ein lano amir l'shayin, ela avinu shebashamayim, that we do have an immense support besides organizations such as this one, but we have the chizuk to understand that Hashem is always watching over us, and He wants what's best for us, and there are moments of challenge because He wants us to grow, and He wants us to deal with those challenges. Rav Huttner, in a famous Igeres, it's written in his Igeres Uchsovim Sefer in Pachad Yitzchak, he points out, he talks about Sheva Yipol Tzadik V'kam, that there are times when the righteous will fall, and that he calls the tipshim, those who are immature or lack intellect, they interpret the verse that the tzaddik falls, you know, seven times and he happens to get up. Rav Fundu says, the amkus of the verse is, the verse in Mishlei is, that ultimately through the sheva nefilos comes the kima. That through the process of the nefila, through the process of struggle, whether it's in our relationships, whether it's in other realms, it's each step in the process of struggling, of dealing with nisayon, of dealing with challenge, that's ultimately what strengthens us to arise in the end and to have the Yeshua and to have the Nechama. That's what he coins the phrase. He borrows it from the secular world, the phrase that you can lose the battle, but win the war. That there are many battles along the way that we may have in our personal lives, in our marriages, right? They always say that the poor Chas and Kala, when they come home, after they have that first fight, they're like, it's like a shvirish enkamo. They think like the rest of their life, what's going to be? They married the wrong person. But those of us who are more sophisticated and more mature, have been married for more than a few minutes, we appreciate that there are going to be times when there are going to be ups and downs. There are going to be times when we speak nicer to each other. There are times when maybe we're not at our best, so on and so forth. And there are going to be battles that are going to be lost, but we have to keep our vision on the bigger picture of winning the war and not to be discouraged when we lose the battle. I once heard a beautiful analogy, a beautiful mashal, that people are familiar with. Flip a coin, heads or tails. In pre-1948 Israel, so the coin apparently had on one side it had an 8, so it had a tree, and on the other side it said Pali for Palestine. So the kids who lived in Israel in that kufa, they used to play a little game. It was called Eitz or Pali. You would flip the coin, and you would say, you call Eitz or you call Pali, or we would say, call heads or tails. So the image was like this. When you flip the coin, right? So in the interim, sometimes it's Eitz, sometimes it's Pali. Sometimes it's Eitz, sometimes it's Pali. Sometimes it's heads, sometimes it's tails. It doesn't really matter what it is when it's floating in the air. The only thing that's koveh, the only thing that really matters at the end is what it falls on when it lands on the ground. And I think it's a good mashal, the nimshal is, that many times in married life, so there are battles that are going to be lost. There are times when it's not the right coin. There are times when things are not going the way we want them to go. But we have to keep our bigger perspective, the bigger picture, which is that we want to win the war. We want it to come out good in the end. And sometimes for things to come out good in the end, there need to be the trials and tribulations and the mishaps along the way to ensure that things are solidified and things, in fact, come out good at the end. Now, as I transition into some of the particular realms of advice for dealing with our relationships, particularly in challenging times and challenging contexts, I just want to share something that my lovely wife often says, and that is that we, Baruch Hashem, are blessed with four children, and she often says we have five children. And this is a crowd that I think in particular will appreciate what I'm about to say. So I said, we have four children. I said, no, a child with special needs is like two children. And then she tells me this, like, they have these Frum Mother groups online that she's part of, or used to be more part of. So she said, and if you need proof, all the other mothers on the support group say the same thing. Okay? So I just want to point out, so if you think about that, so whether it's true or not, the idea basically is that each of us in this room have bigger families than may be apparent, or, again, greater challenges than may be apparent. And as I began with, marriage is not easy. Marriage is not easy for the two healthiest individuals with everything going for them and all the resources at their disposal. Marriage inherently is difficult because of the nature of man and woman. And that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us as part of our journey in this world to traverse that journey. That's why Chazal talk about this also, that the splitting of man and woman in this story of creation and the Sira and if they were created as one, and all, there's a lot talked about here. These are very deep concepts. At the end of the day, there is a process of being chozer, the Aveda, of finding the lost, the rib, finding all the different aspects of a person, of connecting and unifying with another. That is difficult under the most perfect of circumstances. You now enhance that challenge with resources that are drained or strained because of children, because of less than perfect situations with parnasa, because of people who aren't maybe 100% healthy from their families of origin, because of a child with exceptional needs that may be equivalent quantitatively or qualitatively to multiple children, so on and so forth. Just setting the context, one has to understand that one is on a ground that is very, very, very challenging. So if I haven't validated that for us already, I'm trying to understand that we're dealing with something that's not easy for under the best of circumstances, and certainly not easy in the circumstances that many of us deal with. Okay? Now, that being said, I'd like to spend a few moments talking about some particular eitzot, some particular ideas that can be helpful to us as we try to negotiate these sometimes, wild waters or a little bit bumpy ride. So a few eitzot that I hope can be of some practical import. The first one is that of the necessity to listen, right? It's well known, Chazal say that we're created with one mouth and two sets of ears. We're supposed to have these little parts to close the ear, not to hear things that are inappropriate to listen to. But ultimately, Hashem gave us one mouth and two ears because we're supposed to listen at least twice as much as we talk. Now, many times in marriage and relationships, it's very difficult to listen and to hear the other person. There actually are psychological techniques and methods to help enhance our ability to listen. There's something called the speaker-listener technique, which, again, is not always necessary, but I just mentioned it to be aware. There actually are exercises that we do in marital therapy where we actually, hand one spouse the floor. For example, if this bottle of water is the microphone, so you say, okay, we have a microphone, right? So you say, Mrs., you have the floor right now. And she takes, an imaginary microphone. And he's not allowed to talk until she gives up the floor. And not only does he have to listen, but he has to actually provide feedback and reflect back what he's hearing. Now, if he reflects back, if what he's reflecting back is not what she just said, so she has to call him out on it and say, that's not what I said, and try again until he can reflect back what exactly she said so she feels listened to and heard. Now, this can be very mechanical. It doesn't work in the middle of a huge, the kids are in every direction. Okay, honey, now it's yours, the mic. It doesn't work like that. But it can work when we are trying to refine our relationships and when we have some quiet time in terms of practicing, if we feel that maybe we're not being listened to in the way that we'd like to be listened to. It's an amazing thing. I think when we're dating, there's a beautiful Chassidish Maisa that I once heard. It's not a Maisa, it's like a Vart, in the sense that there's a minhag Yisrael, that the kalah, the kalah's family, presents the chosen with a talis, the week or the day of the chasana. Right? The chosen has other minhagim that he gives to the kalah, candelabra, etc., lechter, different things. So what's the reason? Why does the chosen, why is he imbued or gifted with a talis by the kalah and her family? Well, you say, oh, it's simple. Well, he's now going to, in most communities, he didn't wear a talis until now, and now he's going to wear a talis. The simcha of the chasana, kabbalistically, higher levels. Talis represents being wrapped in the kanfei hashchina, levels of simcha that we spoke about at the beginning. So, of course, he gets the talis. So, Chassidus Rebbe said like this. He said that many of us daven to Hashem, and we have a little bit of a suffix of Hashem is listening to us, particularly when he doesn't fulfill our requests. But there are periods of time where we really feel listened to. When is that? So often when Chas and Kala are dating, in that dating period, and I recognize we have a diverse tzibor, and there might be different amounts of time that different people may date within the tzibor, or if they even date, but be that as it may, the idea is that oftentimes if they're dating for some period of time and everybody's on their best behavior, so it's very likely that our chosen, and it's true of the kala too, for the first time in his life feels profoundly listened to. I remember from my own experience, when I was dating my wife, I remember she gets me, she hears me, she remembers what I say. It's how many people give us that level of attention and focus in our lives? It's an amazing feeling. So, the Rebbe said like this. He said, I don't even know which Rebbe said it, but one Rebbe said it, maybe all the Rebbes say it, and that is that now the Chassan makes the following, diuk. He says like this. He says, if this wonderful young woman can listen to me and hear me, so kal v'chomer menosho kal v'chomer, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, b'chvodo v'atzmo, can listen to me and hear me, and it transforms his tefillah, or her tefillah. They approach davening differently because they know what it feels like to be listened to. It transforms them, metamorphosizes them. So we therefore present the chassan with the talis before he enters the chuppah to reflect or be indicative of the chassan kala now are going to have a new reality of tefillah because they feel for the first time that they're going to be listened to in a very profound, deep way. Unfortunately, what happens many times is that soon after marriage, that attention and that focus and all that energy sometimes begins to dissipate or go by the wayside. Why? Well, I got him already, or I got her already. We did it. And people often, particularly people that spend a lot of time in Shidduchim, they think the whole challenge is to get married. And once they marry, they reach the finish line. And then they get married, they realize, oh my goodness, that was the easy part. The hard part is building a relationship with an individual who is different from me, who comes from a different world than I do, comes from a different background, or maybe not different background, but is different from me in many ways. Like as we said, you have Minsk and you have Vilna and you have Mars and you have Venus, and there are different inherent differences between husband and wife, men and women. It's something that's incredibly challenging. And one of the areas that needs refinement to be able to navigate difficult context in marriage is the ability to listen. If one can't hear what their spouse is saying and use the tools necessary, if need be, to get to a part where one of the spouses feels listened to, and maybe that even includes having a third person be able to intercede and help to the degree that's necessary, one is not going to be able to negotiate the challenges and difficulties, because if we can't hear what each other are saying, so we have a very, very great, burden and challenge. Second area that I mentioned that I think is important is the ability to have time together alone and have time by ourselves alone. So what does that mean? So sometimes, in secular literature it's referred to as a date night, that it's very important, I think, I like to suggest, at least minimally once a month, which I think is actually pretty expansive. Many people ideally want to do this once a week, but at least once a month, there should be an opportunity where husband and wife can spend some time, a few hours together alone, away from the home and away from the children. Now, we all have different budgets and we all have different challenges around us, but it doesn't have to be very costly. There are many things that one could do. One could go get in a car and go to a bookstore, or just, you can do many, and the weather's nice, you can take a walk. It doesn't have to be something that's costly, going out to dinner every month. But the idea that we get out of our normal environment where we interact with each other and have to interact with each other in a new environment, it's almost like recreating the dating process on some level. If you can imagine, right? There are many, many concepts like this in Chazal, right? The whole idea of Taras HaMishpacha is built on recreating what once was in the initial stages of marriage. Similarly, in the emotional social realm, we also want to be able to recreate what once was in terms of the interest and excitement. And the way to do that is to help, sometimes even artificially, creating a new context, getting out of the home, getting away from the children, and being able to see each other in a light. And in addition to that, it's also important to try, to the degree possible, again, there are very mechanical ways to do it, and there are more natural ways to do it, but to have conversation that goes beyond just the business of marriage, right? The business of marriage is the kids, is the bills, is all the things that we have to take care of before we get to relating to one another. And if you think about it, many of us don't see our spouses that much every day, and the space that we do see them, most of that time tends to be filled up with the business of marriage as opposed to the depth or meaning or connection of marriage. So at least minimally, in this once a week or minimally once a month period where we're outside of the, we'll call, business of marriage, we have to try also to relate to each other in terms of our dreams, our aspirations, who we once were, where we're going. Something interesting we read, wherever you may read, whatever papers you may be exposed to, that we're connecting to each other on a realm that's just beyond what I'll call the minutiae or sometimes monotony of life. That is something that's essential and crucial for fortifying our marriages. Now, to be able to do that effectively, we need to also have the space that we each need individually. In the sense that to be a healthy, functioning person, everybody needs to have their own time for themselves. So whether that is, I'm just using, again, I mentioned that I like to golf. You know, my wife sometimes will go have her nails done or something, you know, that speaks to her. Again, it doesn't have to involve spending money. It's just the idea that we respect each other's space, that we're able to say, you know, whether we're able to say in the home, honey, I really want to deal with that issue and I'm not prepared to deal with it right now, but I hope we're going to be able to deal with it tomorrow. I mean, you can give a whole lecture just on communication and how to communicate in marriage. That's, of course, very, very esoteric and very foundational to marriage. But I'm just saying one of the ideas also to dealing with marriage in a tricky or challenging context is to make sure we have time for ourselves, whether that means just time where each spouse enables the other spouse to reflect and to think and to gather themselves and to recharge their batteries, because it's not a question of why does she get and I don't get, or why does he get and why don't I get. It's understanding, again, the totality of the bias that we both benefit when each of us are at our best, at our peak. So if he wants to go learn or go to a shiur or whatever it is, it's giving each other, it's not so much keeping score and how much did I get versus what you get, but to get beyond that and to see that we each have to be at our best, at our optimal, to be able to bring that to the table and to relate to each other. So again, the listening, to be able to really hear each other, which facilitates communication, the ability to be able to have time together alone outside the normal context, and also to have time alone by ourselves to be able to reflect and prepare ourselves. These are all essential ingredients that we have to ensure that we have to deal with the challenges in marriage. I just want to say two other things, and then I'll sum up and I'll open the floor to questions and comments. I think it's important to recognize, particularly when we are dealing with the additional challenges that many of us are, that the small stuff actually does matter. There's books that say, don't sweat the small stuff. I'd like to suggest that particularly in a home that has a special needs child, we need to sweat the small stuff. Now, I don't mean that we need to be overly intense. We need to kind of be relaxed. Don't sweat the small stuff in terms of just trying to be mavata or letting things go. But in the sense that there was a recent blog post that I was showed by none other than my wife shared with me. It was entitled, I Got Divorced Because I Left the Dishes by the Sink. And my wife wanted me to read this. I don't always, I leave my dishes by the sink. She wasn't threatening to divorce me, but it was actually a very clever article in the sense that, I don't know if it was true or not, but it was talking about that the husband always left the dishes by the sink, and the wife felt progressively more and more disrespected every time she noticed that the dishes were left by the sink, because it made her crazy. And she told him, you know, I really, in every way possible, it really bothers me when you do X, and he kept doing X. He wasn't able to hear her that, what's dishes? What's the big deal? The marriage going to break up over dishes? But it didn't break up over dishes. It broke up over the disrespect that and the lack of respect and how that was eroding over many years of interactions where the other person doesn't feel listened to. One of the biggest sodos in marriage is to like what your spouse loves, which means that you don't have to, everything they aspire toward or love doesn't have to be your favorite thing, but you have to be able to respect it. You have to be able to relate to it. Right? I happen to love sports, and America football is very popular. And my wife is European, so she doesn't really know from this stuff. But to her credit, if we're ever talking about something, she'll try to chime in or say something intelligent or contribute to the conversation. It's such a small thing, but that's what I'm talking about. Really being machshiv the other person, understanding who they are, not judging them, not criticizing them, not assessing, you know, I don't hold with this. Like, you marry this person. You know, you must have held with them at some point. And the avoda is to try the best you can to be there and to be responsive to their needs. Now, none of us are perfect. None of us are machines. None of us can always you know, we can't read the other one's mind. We can't, like, do it before, you know. Sometimes we need to be told things, you know, like, why don't you read my mind? You know, that's not, you know, that's not a reasonable expectation. But that being said, there really has to be a concerted effort to, that the small stuff does matter. That when somebody, when your spouse tells you to pick your socks up off the floor 10 times, and you think, what's the big deal? It's a big deal because it's a big deal to her, or vice versa. That's what makes it a big deal. It's not because objectively you don't think it's a big deal. It's because subjectively, if she feels or he feels the need to mention it 10 times, for whatever reason, it's a big deal. And not responding to that is disrespectful and is eroding the marriage. And I think when we have so many additional challenges that are floating around, to let these small things gnaw away and eat away, we can't afford it. No one could afford it, but we in particular can't afford it. Because we have so many other things we have to deal with, we really have to be there for our spouses in the small ways that we can be. And finally, I think this is rather obvious, organizations like Yidei Chesed, in terms of having the appropriate support network. I'm very involved with Yachad, which is under the auspices of the Orthodox Union. I work for Yachad in a professional capacity. We also have you shouldn't talk about other organizations in the milieu of a different organization, but we also run family Shabbatons and weekends. It's very important to have support, to be together with people that are similarly situated, to be able to share experiences, to be mechazik each other. For those who use technology, there are various online support groups. To have family, you know, as you know, I don't know about you, many people don't get us. Like we function our own reality. And some people don't want to, you know, it's gotten better in terms of the special needs world and the cause. And many of us try to bring it to light and to promote inclusion. But it's not a davar pashut, it's not so simple. And we all need to have appropriate support. We need to have, as best as we can, strengthening our family units, having, whether it's siblings, having babysitters, having chevra, having weekends, etc. We have to, of course, optimize the opportunities that we have. I finally just want to conclude. I'm going to say two last things before I open the floor to questions or comments. The first thing is, as was mentioned, I have this book. I just was a labor of love. I just wrote this book. It just came out January, last month. It's brand new. It's called We're Almost There, Living with Patience, Perseverance, and Purpose. And very much, it's autobiographical in certain ways. And it has six sections of the book. One section of the book, as I mentioned earlier, is about marital harmony and shiduchim and getting along with our spouses. And one section is about raising a child with special needs. So I don't expect everyone in the room to buy the book. As I said, it's a discount to the price of $20. But being that we all are parents of special needs children, so certainly that section is very relevant, and marriage is certainly relevant. And I have a section on strengthening faith in challenging times, a section in friends, family, and community, being present, living in the moment. It's based on the premise. My wife is a nurse, and she's studying now to become a midwife. And in the process of the midwifery training, they taught her that you have to hold the vision and trust the process. That in the birthing context, we the men don't know, but the women certainly know. We maybe have heard or observed that it's incredibly painful to give birth, and there are times when a woman will want to give up, or she'll, you know, carbonos come afterwards because of the thoughts that a woman may have in that pain. But ultimately, one has to hold the vision of getting there, of having the child, and trusting the process, that even though it's painful at times, that's the process necessary to be traversed to reach the end game, to reach the end goal. And a lot of the book is about this theme, that a lot of times in life we're stuck, we're not getting places that we want to get to, but ultimately, if we hold the vision and trust the process, we're ultimately much closer than we think, and we will arrive. And finally, I'm just going to end with the following chiddush. It's a chiddush in the sense that many of you may argue with me, and I'm not sure how much I believe the chiddush myself, but I'm going to put it out there to reflect upon. I remember my wife and I are married now almost 12 years, and our oldest, Yedidya, who has Down syndrome, was born in Yerushalayim, Yir HaKodesh, and it was our first child. And after he was born, we were, of course, thrown for a loop. It was a very big surprise. My wife was 21 years old at the time. It was very, very jarring, and it took us a number of months to kind of get our bearing. And many people tried to offer chizuk and support, some more successfully, some less successfully. But I remember one individual came over to me and told me shared a personal anecdote that I was thinking about in preparing this talk. And he said that I had a sibling with special needs, this individual said to me, and it actually helped my parents' marriage tremendously. It actually brought them together. It strengthened their connection. It really, really solidified their marriage. Now, I understood at the time he was trying to tell me in some warped way that having this pitzula with special needs, although I was frightened to death, was somehow going to help me and help my marriage. Now, over time, I've come to realize, and as I've written about at length in the book, I've come to realize how having this child in my life and in my family has greatly enhanced my life and my family's life and has been a bracha in many, many ways. But I would venture to be mechadesh or to suggest that to the degree that we're able to implement some of the ideas that I suggested, some of the practical ideas, and understand the inherent challenges that exist in every marriage, even people that have the most perfect of circumstances, that on some level, in some way, we may even have a special secret weapon in our marriages. Because, as you all know, the level of dedication and effort and energy that's required to nurture and raise and bring out the potential of such a child is something that unifies and bonds us with our spouses in a way that nobody could truly understand. And if I think about it with the utmost honesty, it's unlikely that the kesher that I share with my wonderful Rebbetzin would be as strong as it is without that challenge embedded and implanted within our life. So even though the premise of this lecture was in fact talking about strengthening our marriages, particularly when we have an additional, I don't like to use the word burden, but the word challenge in our lives, I would like to flip it on its head, say fakert, that in some level, in some, again, deep way that we're not always cognizant of, that this person may in fact have been onto something, that we do have on some level a tool, and maybe our Kadosh Baruch Hu in his infinite wisdom knows what, not maybe, he knows what each of us need in our own lives, in our own marriages, that he has planted within each of our lives and each of our relationships a tool, another mechanism to help us strengthen our kesher with our spouse, with our children, and ultimately with him. Because as we began this talk, the tachlis or focus or purpose of the period we find ourselves in, the period of Adar, is that Aleph Dar, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu should Dar, he should reside within us. That it's not a coincidence that Parshas Truma is coming in Adar, because Truma is all about building a Mishkan. And when you're building the Mishkan, so what we're trying to do in our lives, particularly in Adar, is to build our own Mishkan Ma'at in our Bayit, and to welcome HaKadosh Baruch Hu Shechina to be Shora within that Bayit. And if we do that, we're Zocha to be Ish V'Isha, Shechina Shruya, Beinehem. And my bracha to all of you is HaKadosh Baruch Hu should give all of us strength to continue in our Avodas HaKodesh, to have the best perspectives, to get chizik from weekends such as this, and to bring HaKadosh Baruch Hu Nachas, which is really what he has placed us in this world to do. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you for inviting me, and thank you for listening. And now I'm happy to address any questions openly, publicly, if anybody wants to take advantage of the opportunity. And if not, I'll be around. I'm going to stay around a little bit for the brunch, and we can speak there as well. And again, I welcome you to purchase the book for the discounted price of $20 if you're interested. Thank you so much. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm not sure if this is what you meant, but my great uncle of Shimon said on the bar, that you started off early with. It's in the word itself. And the Ma'at in Av tells us the word itself that is always Simcha, but sometimes you're just going to heighten it like a gas range.
Right.
Really enjoyed it.
Shukaya, thanks. Thoughts, questions, comments?
Why golf? I quit after I realized that I got so frustrated when I was 17 years old. Yeah. The ball went 50 feet. I threw the club further than I could hit the ball.
Right.
And I said, finished.
It's hard to explain that until you've experienced it, and particularly
not miniature golf. Right?
No, it's a good lesson for life, because when you hit that one perfect shot, out of all the mishaps, it makes all the mishaps worth it. And if there's one yesod I tried to bring out also, is that, you know, lose the battles but win the war. And if you can kind of keep the long view and see the vision, you will have the nachas and sibuk at the end.
Well, what pushed you to write the book? The special needs child or your work with marriage and stuff?
It was a confluence of ideas. I was working as the Rav of a shul in Manhattan for the last 9 years until the last 6 months. I recently left this summer. And I was working in a community that was rather transient, and I felt that I had impactful messages to share. I was writing for a Mishpacha magazine, and people were giving positive feedback. And I felt that maybe if I can get some of my thoughts out to a broader audience, it could have a larger impact than the immediate milieu in which I found myself. So I began to write, and the birth of this book kind of came about. It was, I wouldn't say it was an accident, but it just kind of naturally flowed from a lot of years of writing and speaking and sharing thoughts. All right? All right. Shkoyach.
Shkoyach. Okay, now, Rabbi Yisai, before we go into the brunch, I was asked by the caterer, the Glaubers, that if any of you might have taken any plates, dishes, glasses,